This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. One-third of all Black Americans working full-time live below the poverty line. And the economic gap between the rich and the poor is growing more rapidly in the Black community than it is in the white community. The implications of this rift for the Black middle class is the topic of a Frontline documentary airing tomorrow night on public television stations nationwide. It's hosted by Henry Louis Gates. He is the W.E.B. Du Bois Professor of Humanities at Harvard and the chair of its Afro-American Studies Department. In the program, Gates examines affirmative action, in part by telling his own personal story, how a young Black child from a poor family in Piedmont, West Virginia, ended up a member of the intellectual elite.
Well, I entered Yale in 1969 with the largest group of Black people that had ever gone to Yale. The class of 1966 at Yale had 6 Black men to graduate. The class that entered with me in 1969, we were members of class of 73, had 96 Black people. I mean, that was remarkable. And how did we get there? I mean, all of a sudden, Yale found 90 smart Black people who didn't exist in 1966, of course not. I mean, we were the affirmative action generation. We were the first large group of Black people to hit the Ivy League campuses in that year, September of 1969. That was my generation. That was my experience.
Why did you revisit this story and your personal history for a documentary about the growing rift between the Black middle class and the Black underclass?
Well, as many people have said, it's a cliche by now, but it's the best of times and it's the worst of times for the African-American community. We have the largest Black middle class in our history, but simultaneously, 45% of all Black children live at or beneath the poverty line. And no one predicted this outcome in the 1960s. I don't care if they were left or right. I don't care if they were Black nationalists or socialists. How did we get there? And the only way to figure out how we got there, it seems to me, was to go back and to trace that affirmative action generation that hit the historically white schools in the late 1960s.
What lesson do you draw from your own experience that's relevant to the issues facing Black leaders today?
Well, it seems to me that affirmative action has been an enormously positive influence in American society. The reason that the Black middle class is so much bigger today than it was the year that Dr. King was assassinated, for example, is directly traceable to affirmative action. But what's happened is that the size of the Black middle class has become static, almost frozen. It's not growing like we expected it to grow. The society decided to allow some of us into the middle class and then to shut those doors, so that we have two self-perpetuating classes within the Black community, a Black middle class that's larger than it's ever been but not large enough, and this ongoing, horribly suffering Black underclass. And what I'm hoping, what many of us are hoping, is that we can adopt a form of affirmative action that will be focused upon the class differentials in America generally, and more specifically the class differentials within the African-American community. In other words, we have to change the shape of the bell curve of class.
How do you explain, then, the accelerating economic disparity and emotional disparity, I suppose, or psychological or existential disparity is what you're talking about, between those who've benefited from affirmative action, those who've made it, and a Black underclass? Does it mean that the civil rights movement has failed?
I think the civil rights movement has achieved all that it could possibly achieve, given the level of its analysis. You see, for 100 years, we thought that the most important problem facing members of the African-American community was white racism. We didn't think primarily about economic relationships. We thought about almost a primal xenophobia in the white American community. If they saw a Black face, they would hate that person. They would find that person ugly. They would try to punish that person. They would try to delimit the possibilities of that person. The primary cause of our oppression was race. Whereas, in fact, though it took a century between slavery and the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1965 to achieve this, though, in fact, once we could get rid of de jure segregation, the number of Black people who could enter the middle class turned out to be surprisingly large, and their movement into the middle class went surprisingly quickly. But the argument of the civil rights establishment was that all of us would plunge headlong into the middle class, and that was naive. It never was going to happen. Marcuse, the philosopher, Angela Davis's professor, predicted this in 1958, and no one believed him. I mean, he said the civil rights movement will create a new black middle class. That will be its primary effect. Well, in 1958, that seemed like a big deal, and in retrospect, it was a big deal. I mean, don't get me wrong. The fact that we have such a large black middle class compared to the black middle class before 1968 is a wonderful thing. My concern is that that class is not growing, and the size of the black underclass is growing.
How has the civil rights movement changed to accommodate this growing economic disparity in the black community?
I don't think any of us knows what to do about it. I don't think that there is a realistic or effective analysis floating out there that accounts for this disparity within the African-American community. And I don't think that even many of my friends who are staunch proponents of affirmative action like I am, I don't think that they know what to do about the class gap within the black community. That is our primary problem today. Our primary problem is not white racism, as awful as white racism continues to be. It is our inability to figure out how to expand the size of the black middle class, how to affect both structurally and behaviorally the causes of poverty that are punishing so many people of color in this country. And I think that many of us have been reluctant to say that the causes of poverty are both structural and behavioral, meaning there are systematic things, meaning that there are systemic things that we have to do, but meaning also that simultaneously that we need a moral revolution within the African-American community. There are certain forms of behavior that we have to find unacceptable and intolerable within our community. There's absolutely no reason for people to have dysfunctional families to the extent that African-Americans have. The out-of-wedlock birth rate is horribly high. We have to do something about that. We have to demand that each member of the black community assume responsibility for her behavior or his behavior. We have to be firm about these things. But at the same time, lest I sound like a right-wing conservative, we have to insist that there are job opportunities opened up for every person in this country who is seriously seeking a job, has the skills for a job, and is determined to meet the requirements of the workplace. And that is the situation which does not exist in this country today.
Now, critics of affirmative action come in and respond that the 60s were all about breaking down the barriers of race, but now it's all about class. It's what you're saying is all about class. Where does that leave the race issue in affirmative action? Why have affirmative action based on skin color if we've moved into a class debate?
Well, I think that that's the question that we all have to begin to ask ourselves. I mean, should my children benefit from affirmative action? And if so, why? And if not, why not? I mean, this is a serious question. My children will probably be very successful individuals. I mean, I would hope they're very well educated. They're highly motivated. They come from a middle class home. Should they benefit from affirmative action in the same way, let's say, that I benefited from affirmative action as a working class person from Appalachia? Or should they benefit from affirmative action in the same way that some of their friends who live in the inner city, say in Roxbury here in Boston, benefit? These are questions that we have to begin to ask ourselves. I tend to be much more sympathetic toward an affirmative action that includes as one of its principles or premises the matter of scarcity or economic relationship or class. Use whatever term that you want. But there will come a point when the black middle class will escape the necessity or escape the need for affirmative action breaks. The question is, have we arrived there yet? Probably not. I tend to think that we need three generations of affirmative action benefit to make make solid the perpetuation of middle class status. But when will that when will that third generation manifest itself? Am I the first generation? Am I the second generation? My daughter's the third generation? And then what do you do then? Well, I am concerned that we cannot survive as a community, to use that metaphor, unless the size of the middle class within the African-American people increases. And the only way that it can increase is through affirmative action.
My guest is Henry Louis Gates, Jr. He's the Du Bois Professor of the Humanities and the chair of the Department of Afro-American Studies at Harvard University. Tomorrow night, he hosts a PBS Frontline documentary that measures the success of the civil rights movement. It's called The Two Nations of Black America. We're going to take a break for a minute, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Harvard University Professor Henry Louis Gates, Jr. He serves as a correspondent for the PBS series Frontline. Tomorrow night on Frontline, he hosts a documentary on the rift in the black community between the black middle class and the black poor. The show is titled The Two Nations of Black America. You explore a number of issues of identity in the Frontline piece, both the identity of the idea of the monolith of the black community as a whole, and also personal identity. And you pose an interesting question to Cornel West. He's a philosopher and a professor at Harvard. You ask what it means to be black now as opposed to what it meant to be black in the 60s. How did he answer?
He said that we had a much more unified community in 1967 than we do today. We have much more fragmentation, much more nihilism, much more despair. You see, we were united by white racism, as terrible as that might sound, but we were. We had a common enemy, and the enemy was clear. If we could just get rid of George Wallace and Orville Faubus and Bull Connors, everything would be better. We could reach the promised land. The problem is that we did. The problem is that we did get rid of those symbols of de jure segregation and of de jure segregation itself. And what was the result? Well, what was the result was that some of us entered the middle class and a lot of us stayed behind. We had spent 100 years trying to get rid of legal segregation. And we thought that once we did, all of our problems would be solved. And that is because of our own failures of analysis of the complexities of the American system. And we confused what turns out to have been class distinctions or class differentials or class oppression with racial oppression. We missed the boat, I think, by that confusion or because of that confusion. And many of us now are trying to do something about it. I don't think anyone seriously wants a socialist revolution or believes that that's even possible. The question becomes, how can we redistribute wealth in this country in such a way to diminish the size of the underclass black and white? That is the moral and political problem, I think, confronting our generation of African-American intellectuals.
I find it really interesting that you say in the program that you feel alienated from the people that you're trying to reach out to, a young urban black culture, and you mentioned gangster rap, that in particular just confounds you. And it just occurred to me that that every middle-aged person feels alienated from the popular culture of young people, whether it's music or their social habits and their social context.
Our parents were alienated from us. I remember when I grew an afro, my father, particularly my uncle, thought it was the ugliest thing that he had ever seen. They thought all of our romantic notions about Africa and about black identity were just total rubbish. They thought the race was falling apart. So I think that the generation alienation is part and parcel of the African-American experience like every other experience. I don't think that that's new. But I think that the what I feel alienated from is not the younger generation of African-American people. After all, I make my living teaching the younger generation and younger generations, whether they're black or white, and I'm very close to my students, black and white. I don't feel that form of alienation. I feel a form of alienation from a certain lifestyle, and it's a lifestyle that is so counter, so opposed to the values that the members of my community shared when I was that age and continue to share beyond through my college years. We believed in the future. We believed in ourselves as a people. We thought that things would get better, and we thought that they would get better if we worked together. And we had hope. We cherished hope. As Cornell says in his latest book, Restoring Hope, our challenge is how to restore the hope that we enjoyed, that we experienced as members of the African-American community in the 1950s and 1960s and throughout much of the 1970s. The depth of despair is shocking. It is the depth of alienation, it is the depth of fragmentation within the Black community that that frightens me, that alienates me, that makes me wonder, what does a gangster lifestyle have to do with the African-American experience that I love, that I cherish, and indeed that I teach and write about? Where did this come from? What's it a symbol of? What's it a function of? And what do we do about it? That's what worries me. There is clearly a difference between the fabric of African-American society and faith and hope and belief structures of the 1960s and those same things today. And that's worrisome.
Well, one conclusion of the Frontline program is that we, meaning America, needs the same kind of interracial coalition that was at the center of the civil rights movement 30 years ago. And one of your commentators, the urban sociologist, William Julius Wilson, says in response to that'll be very difficult because people of different races are even more divided than they were in the 60s now. They're even less able or less willing to work together than back then. Do you think that's true? And why, if the real problem is class, is it true?
Well, I think that it's... Boy, it's a tough one. The historic liberal coalition, of course, has fallen apart between Blacks and liberal Jewish people and liberal members of the WASP community, et cetera, et cetera. It's become fissured. There was an old joke in West Virginia that there were so many political splinters in the Democratic Party, they didn't have factions, they had fractions. And we have a fractionated liberal coalition, I think, or the remnants of that coalition. And we have to figure out how to put it back together because the problems are beyond race or religion or the interests of one group. We have to figure out, just like a successful marriage, I mean, we have to figure out common ground. We have to figure out ways to disagree about issues where we can't produce a consensus and identify what the problems are that are afflicting this society, like unemployment, like poverty, and then adopt a common program toward addressing those problems. But we can't do it from the safety of our little ghettos, whether they're religious ghettos or ethnic ghettos or gender-based ghettos. We have to figure out a way to agree to disagree and to reforge those coalitions. And many of us are trying to do that, without a doubt. Many of us are working hard to re-cement the relationships between the liberal Jewish community and the African-American civil rights leadership. And that, of course, fell apart because of affirmative action, by and large, and we need to figure out ways to put that back together.
You teach young people at Harvard. Do you have people, students coming to you and saying, grappling with the same issues that you raise in this program? Who am I? What's my responsibility to people who haven't made it? What does it mean to be Black now in 1998?
Oh, every day. I mean, the degree of guilt about one's own individual the degree of guilt about one's individual success at a place like Harvard is enormous. And so what I tell them, and I think what my colleagues tell them, is that the most important thing you can do for the Black community, the blackest thing that you can do, is to be successful. Bust the books, get straight A's, go to law school if that's what you want to do, become a professor if that's what you want to do. That is a fundamental part of the African-American experience. I read a poll recently. It was a Gallup poll of inner-city Black kids, and it said, basically, I'm paraphrasing here, but list things white. And on that list included the following: getting straight A's, speaking standard English, visiting the Smithsonian Institution. Now, if anyone had said anything like that when I was growing up, first of all, your mother would have beat your behind, and then secondly, they would have checked you into a mental institution. I mean, this is alarming, that these things, that success, individual success, would be identified as something white that is alien to the African-American community. That is sad, and that is worrisome. We've internalized racist stereotypes about ourselves, and we have to fight as leaders of the African American community against this internalization process, against those stereotypes, which many of us live out every day.
Henry Louis Gates, I really want to thank you very much for talking today on Fresh Air.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Henry Louis Gates is the W.E.B. Du Bois Professor of Humanities at Harvard. He hosts the Frontline documentary, The Two Nations of Black America,